Although keeping in mind the necessity for strict economy with our scanty store of food, I knew how important it was to keep the men cheerful, and that the depression occasioned by our surroundings and our precarious position could, to some extent, be alleviated by increasing the rations, at least until we were more accustomed to our new mode of life. That this was successful is shown in their diaries. Day by day goes by, much the same as one another. We work, we talk, we eat. Ah, how we eat! No longer on short rations, we are a trifle more exacting than we were when we first commenced our simple life. But by comparison with home standards, we are positive barbarians, and our gastronomic rapacity knows no bounds. All is eaten that comes to each tent, and everything is most carefully and accurately divided into as many equal portions as there are men in the tent. One member then closes his eyes or turns his head away and calls out the names at random, as the cook for the day points to each portion, saying at the same time, "Whose?" Partiality, however unintentional it may be, is thus entirely obviated, and everyone feels satisfied that all is fair, even though one may look a little enviously at the next man's helping, which differs in some especially appreciated detail from one's own. We break the 10th commandment energetically, but as we are all in the same boat in this respect, no one says a word. We understand each other's feelings quite sympathetically. It is just like school days over again, and very jolly it is too, for the time being. Later on, as the prospect of wintering in the pack became more apparent, the rations had to be considerably reduced. By that time, however, everybody had become more accustomed to the idea, and took it quite as a matter of course. Our meals now consisted in the main of a fairly generous helping of seal or penguin, either boiled or fried. As one man wrote, "We are now having enough to eat, but not by any means too much, and everyone is always hungry enough to eat every scrap he can get. Meals are invariably taken very seriously, and little talking is done till the hoosh is finished." Our tents made somewhat cramped quarters, especially during mealtimes. Living in a tent without any furniture requires a little getting used to. For our meals we have to sit on the floor, and it is surprising how awkward it is to eat in such a position. It is better by far to kneel and sit back on one's heels, as do the Japanese. Each man took it in turn to be the tent cook for one day, and one writes, "The word cook is at present rather a misnomer, for whilst we have a permanent galley, no cooking need be done in the tent. Really, all that the tent cook has to do is to take his two hoosh pots over to the galley and convey the hoosh and the beverage to the tent, clearing up after each meal and washing up the two pots and the mugs. There are no spoons, etc., to wash, for we each keep our own spoon and pocket knife in our pockets. We just lick them as clean as possible and replace them in our pockets after each meal. Our spoons are one of our indispensable possessions here. To lose one spoon would be almost as serious as it is for an edentate person to lose his set of false teeth." During all this time, the supply of seals and penguins, if not inexhaustible, was always sufficient for our needs. Seal and penguin hunting was our daily occupation, and parties were sent out in different directions to search among the hummocks and the pressure ridges for them. When one was found, a signal was hoisted, usually in the form of a scarf or a sock on a pole, and an answering signal was hoisted at the camp. Then Wild went out with a dog team to shoot and bring in the game. To feed ourselves and the dogs, at least one seal a day was required. The seals were mostly crab-eaters, and emperor penguins were the general rule. On November 5th, however, an adelie was caught, and this was the cause of much discussion, as the following extract shows. "The man on watch from 3 a.m. to 4 a.m. caught an adelie penguin. This is the first of its kind that we have seen since January last, and it may mean a lot. It may signify that there is land somewhere near us, or else that great leads are opening up. But it is impossible to form more than a mere conjecture at present. No skuas, Antarctic petrels, or sea leopards were seen during our 2 months' stay at Ocean Camp." In addition to the daily hunt for food, our time was passed in reading the few books that we had managed to save from the ship. The greatest treasure in the library was a portion of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. This was being continually used to settle the inevitable arguments that would arise. The sailors were discovered one day engaged in a very heated discussion on the subject of money and exchange. They finally came to the conclusion that the encyclopedia, since it did not coincide with their views, must be wrong. for descriptions of every American town that ever has been, is, or ever will be, and for full and complete biographies of every American statesman since the time of George Washington and long before, the encyclopedia would be hard to beat. Owing to our shortage of matches, we have been driven to use it for purposes other than the purely literary ones, though. And one genius, having discovered that the paper used for its pages had been impregnated with saltpeter, we can now thoroughly recommend it as a very efficient pipe lighter. We also possessed a few books on Antarctic exploration, a copy of Browning, and one of The Ancient Mariner. On reading the latter, we sympathized with him and wondered what he had done with the albatross. It would have made a very welcome addition to our larder. The two subjects of most interest to us were our rate of drift and the weather. Worsley took observations of the sun whenever possible, and his results showed conclusively that the drift of our floe was almost entirely dependent upon the winds and not much affected by currents. Our hope, of course, was to drift northwards to the edge of the pack, and then, when the ice was loose enough, to take to the boats and row to the nearest land. We started off in fine style, drifting north about 20 miles in 2 or 3 days in a howling southwesterly blizzard. Gradually, however, we slowed up, as successive observations showed, until we began to drift back to the south. An increasingly northeasterly wind, which commenced on November 7th and lasted for 12 days, damped our spirits for a time, until we found that we had only drifted back to the south 3 miles, so that we were now 17 miles to the good. This tended to reassure us in our theories that the ice of the Weddell Sea was drifting round in a clockwise direction, and that if we could stay on our piece long enough, we must eventually be taken up to the north, where lay the open sea and the path to comparative safety. The ice was not moving fast enough to be noticeable. In fact, the only way in which we could prove that we were moving at all was by noting the change of relative positions of the bergs around us, and, more definitely, by fixing our absolute latitude and longitude by observations of the sun. Otherwise, as far as actual visible drift was concerned, we might have been on dry land. For the next few days we made good progress, drifting 7 miles to the north on November 24th and another 7 miles in the next 48 hours. We were all very pleased to know that although the wind was mainly southwest all this time, yet we had made very little easting. The land lay to the west, so had we drifted to the east, we should have been taken right away to the centre of the entrance to the Weddell Sea, and our chances of finally reaching land would have been considerably lessened. Our average rate of drift was slow, and many and varied were the calculations as to when we should reach the pack edge. On December 12, 1915, one man wrote, "Once across the Antarctic Circle, it will seem as if we are practically halfway home again. And it is just possible that with favourable winds we may cross the circle before the new year. A drift of only 3 miles a day would do it, and we have often done that and more for periods of 3 or 4 weeks. We are now only 250 miles from Paulet Island, but too much to the east of it. We are approaching the latitudes in which we were at this time last year on our way down. The ship left South Georgia just a year and a week ago, and reached this latitude 4 or 5 miles to the eastward of our present position on January 3, 1915, crossing the circle on New Year's Eve. Thus, after a year's incessant battle with the ice, we had returned, by many strange turns of fortune's wheel, to almost identically the same latitude that we had left with such high hopes and aspirations 12 months previously. But under what different conditions now? Our ship crushed and lost, and we ourselves drifting on a piece of ice at the mercy of the winds. However, in spite of occasional setbacks due to unfavourable winds, our drift was in the main very satisfactory, and this went a long way towards keeping the men cheerful. As the drift was mostly affected by the winds, the weather was closely watched by all, and Hussey, the meteorologist, was called upon to make forecasts every 4 hours, and sometimes more frequently than that. A meteorological screen containing thermometers and a barograph had been erected on a post frozen into the ice, and observations were taken every 4 hours. When we first left the ship, the weather was cold and miserable, and altogether as unpropitious as it could possibly have been for our attempted march. Our first few days at Ocean Camp were passed under much the same conditions. At nights, the temperature dropped to zero with blinding snow and drift. 1 hour watches were instituted, all hands taking their turn. And in such weather this job was no sinecure. The watchmen had to be continually on the alert for cracks in the ice or any sudden changes in the ice conditions, and also had to keep his eye on the dogs, who often became restless, fretful, and quarrelsome in the early hours of the morning. At the end of his hour, he was very glad to crawl back into the comparative warmth of his frozen sleeping bag.